Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Eric Tagadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to KBOO Portland. My name is Zachary Jones-Nure, and I had the chance to speak to Jamie Dunphy. Born and raised in Portland, Oregon, the chair of the Music Policy Council under Music Portland's Board of Directors spoke to me about his campaign against Live Nation, the world-leading live entertainment company, and its threat to the DIY music scene right here. If it is under a bridge, in my opinion, then you're not really seeing the real show.
Trollcore,
completely. So, along the conversations of bridges and one of the many iconic symbols of Portland, whether it's one of the 12 that we happen to have, Portland has a reputation of a very well-developed, rich DIY scene. You know, whether it's from its roots in punk, grunge, indie rock, and pretty much every genre that you can think of, we have a real identity in the scene itself. And I wonder, for those who may not have been able to witness this scene, what's so special about Portland to you, and how would you describe it to the newcomers of this city, maybe?
Yeah, you know, I grew up as a musician in this city. I spent my 20s in the back of a smelly van with my friends. I had a real effort to make a go of it. Portland used to be in a really affordable city. It used to be a city where you could work 20 hours a week as a barista and afford your rent. And because it rained 9 months of the year, you just grabbed a guitar and you were inside all day and you figured it out. And so everybody had a band. Everybody was doing their own thing. We had, for decades, we've had vibrant, interesting, artistic, creative, and innovative different expressions of music. We're not a single genre town. We've never been able to be pigeonholed. Our largest growing genre right now is the hip-hop scene, which historically Portland has not been particularly welcoming to. But Portland used to be a jazz town. Portland has had a vibrant rock scene for a long time. We have an increasingly growing country scene. But Portland is not an affordable place to live anymore. And jobs are not paying what they should. And post-COVID, crowds have not come back the way they were. So we're facing a series of conflicting problems, all converging problems, all meeting in the same point where it is putting downward pressure on the infrastructure necessary for a vibrant independent music scene. It's putting pressure on the jobs that are created and supportive of the artists up on stage. And it is an opportunity for really opportunistic corporations to be able to sneak in and try to steal away something while they think nobody's looking.
So for the listeners that might not know what Music Portland is, could you give us an explanation of the organization's mission and its current campaign against Live Nation, what you were just talking about?
Absolutely. So Music Portland is a nonprofit trade organization focused on supporting Portland's independent music industry. We are an advocacy organization. We are a professional development organization. We are focused on the economics of supporting the music industry. In my opinion, people always often view music as part of the arts, and they view arts as a nice to have. They view it as a precious little thing that you can hold in your hands, and that it's always the first thing that gets cut whenever budgets are cut. Music Portland has made a very different argument. We knew that this is jobs, this is economic development, this is financial investment, this is community safety. Music is an enormous industry. And so what Music Portland actually did is we got the state of Oregon to recognize commercial music and live performance as emerging economic industries, and they did statewide economic impact studies of this. And we discovered that music industry in Oregon is almost $3.8 billion a year. It employs more people, it generates more income, and it pays more in taxes than salmon, than cannabis, and then timber. and 80% of that is in Portland proper. This is a $3 billion industry in Portland alone. And compared to the nonprofit arts, there was a big report out from the Americans for the Nonprofit Arts who announced that in Portland, all of the nonprofit arts combined are roughly $288 million a year. That means that the music industry alone is worth 10 times all other art in this city combined. We are the fourth largest music city in America. We're the last major music city without a Live Nation venue. And we're the only major music city that's doing it without any formal recognition from government. You know, the city of Austin is only the live music capital of the world because their city council voted to call it that. So we're our mission as Music Portland is to recognize and defend and strategically support the music industry. This is not about meaningless proclamations from elected officials saying how much they love music industry. This is about fixing the noise code so that cops can't shut down shows arbitrarily when a neighbor complains. This is about changing the zoning code so that when a triplex gets built behind a 100-year-old music venue, it's the responsibility of the triplex to install adequate insulation so that the new neighbors aren't insulted. This is about creating site-specific solutions for musicians, like expanding the musician loading zone program so that musicians can just pull in and offload their amp out of the back of their car rather than risking getting a ticket or parking a couple blocks away and having it stolen out of the back of their car. So these are really meaningful ways that we're trying to support the music industry from a policy level and also on an economic individual level with professional skills and trying to help musicians recognize that they themselves are small businesses. And that's why we ultimately have come to this campaign against Live Nation. Live Nation, for our listeners out there, Live Nation is the largest music promotion, tour, and artist agency in the world right now. They own venues, they own tour promotions, they own artist contracts, they own concessioners contracts. They own Ticketmaster. Ticketmaster owns StubHub and SeatGeek. They own all components of the artist music angle, and last year they profited over $20 billion out of the music industry, an industry that is supposed to be struggling. Ticketmaster is the reason that your ticket prices double when you hit go purchase them for your Taylor Swift tickets. Live Nation has a long history of terrible business practices and anti-competitive behavior, and in fact that behavior is so egregious that the U.S. Department of Justice and now 37 U.S. states have filed lawsuit against them. I'm personally surprised because, you know, when has the U.S. Department of Justice or the U.S. government ever seen a monopoly that they didn't love? This is that bad that we're all signing up to try and say that this company needs to be broken up. And at the same time, Prosper Portland, the city's economic development agency, is partnering with Beam Development and Colas Construction, two honestly great local companies who I've known for a long time, and I truly believe were hoping to do something positive for the arts community in Portland. But they're partnering together with Live Nation, and this whole project is proposing a 3,500-person music venue in the Central East Side. We've spent 2 years trying to get some basic protections for the music industry from Live Nation and some basic guarantees that they're not going to do what they've done in every other city. So to date, they have ignored us. They have not agreed to anything. And so they actually went and applied for a conditional use permit to begin construction. And so because of the very clear track record of how Live Nation has carried themselves and the specifics about this project in the location of where it is, Music Portland has had to hire lawyers and challenge this permit. We are appealing this permit to Portland City Council, and we are leading a campaign citywide to try and raise awareness for the local industry to stand up and say that we're not going to welcome the Walmart of music into Portland.
It's completely accurate, and I think we're headed into a different era for what the music scene will look like. Outside of lawmakers, outside of nonprofit organizations and the musicians out there who are trying to spread the word, what can the average Portland listener do in their own free time to try to bring more awareness and, most of all, try to bring more action towards protecting this community that we all cherish so much?
Yeah, we need our voices to be heard, and we need it to be heard loudly by not just the folks who are directly involved, but the average person out there. So we have created a website, musicportland.org/livenation, where folks can go directly and with a few clicks of a button can send an email to every member of Portland City Council and the mayor. We need them to know that our voices are being heard, because we need to flood each of those inboxes and let this know that this is a political decision, that the city council is going to be the ones to make this choice. Additionally, we are actively crowdfunding the necessary money that is going to be required to hire these lawyers. In fact, the administrative appeal fee, not even before we've even made an argument in this hearing or had to hire our lawyers, it's almost a $7,000 fee just to appeal it. And so the nonprofit organization Music Portland is taking that on right now. So we need listeners to help us get access to small donors or to maybe some music industry folks who really care, who can help us front the what we expect to be almost $20,000 in this campaign. And then lastly is just to get involved, to read as much as they can, and to reach out and offer to volunteer. All of that is available with just a couple of clicks on our website. We try to make it as easy to get people involved, but there's a lot of passion here, and we want to put that to good use.
Towards that theme of passion, I think that's one of the greater themes that I've understood from the DIY scene, is that it's based off of this equilibrium of everyone putting in the work, being such a vital element of the house show scene, the DIY scene, and how that feels to people. How can we create this hybridized format where, yes, it's underground, but we're also being supported by real institutions who understand the cultural and symbolic value of having this music scene?
No, absolutely. Music is a spectrum, from the casual person who plays in their living room to the beginner who's up on stage for the first time at an open mic, to the careerist who's building their career all the way up to that professional level where you're just paying your rent full time. And we need every step in between. House shows, DIY shows, live concerts under the park, out in parks and under bridges, are all parts of that spectrum. We have gaps in that spectrum, and we also have gaps in how we support those spectrums. It's so much easier for government to understand, okay, this is a bar. That bar has a stage. That stage has a sound system. And that, therefore, we can get the liquor license, we can get the occupancy license, we can get the sound license. It's much harder for folks to understand the difference between a house concert and maybe something that is truly rowdy and out of place. But more than anything, we need consistent standards, and we need what's called a prescriptive path. We need a way for this to happen that is allowed, and we need to be able to explain it to the average person who wants to have a backyard barbecue, wants to have band practice in their space, and they want to do it in a way that is respectful to the neighbors, but is intentional and still allows for that art and culture and vibrancy to be part of the community. Music Portland is really strategic about these things. We have members of our board who are on the, or members of our organization who are also members of the Noise Review Board for the City of Portland. We have members who are on the Title 14 Noise Code Review Work Group and the Title 18 Noise Code Review Work Group. We are deep in the weeds, and we really are trying to make that fill that space in the advocacy realm so that we're really thinking about all of those options and holding elected officials accountable, because in my experience, the music industry is a lot like a herd of cats, herding cats. Every one of them doesn't see themselves necessarily as part of a broader scene. Maybe within the same genre, maybe within a specific industry, people see each other as aligned. But musicians don't hang out with each other sort of across genres. Music Portland's really trying to change that paradigm. This is part of it, is creating an intentional space where we can all be recognized as part of a broader thing, because truly we are stronger when we are independent together.
For those who have not been to an underground show, for those who are more used to the Moda Center than maybe the underground stage set up under, you know, Morrison or any other bridge, as we've said before, or some abandoned warehouse, the list goes on. But for those listeners, what would they be missing out on if this were to continue with Live Nation's movement in Portland? And I guess, what is the overall value of having this scene for any Portlander who might be interested or might not be?
Live Nation makes it harder for organic opportunities for this industry to grow. It makes it harder for, I mean, there are already immense real estate pressures. There are immense, you know, we're in a growing, dense urban community. The reality of what my experience when I was in my 20s trying to do pop-up shows at the back of bike shops along Foster, or some of these venues are now fancy sushi restaurants, or you know, the Ash Street Saloon is now a Bay's Fried Chicken. Like, the city that I grew up in is gone. it may be that what we know of as the DIY scene is not going to be able to move forward the way it has. Those industrial spaces are getting busier. We need to create intentional pathways for everybody to have that. What Live Nation does, though, is it reduces competition. It reduces opportunities for innovation. And what they explicitly do is they try to monopolize all of the components of an industry. In every city that they've opened a music venue, independent music venues have either been sold or gone out of business. And it's not an accident. It's intentional. And like I said, we need that to exist as a spectrum. All of these tinier venues rely on the bigger venues in order to have that flow of artists go through. We rely on each other as part of an ecosystem. And if one part of that comes in and really actively disrupts that for intentional reasons, for money reasons, we lose that space for us to be able to have that artist who starts from the DIY scene, grows through the house scene, gets to the small stages, and gets up onto the main stage. It's really happening in every other community. Nashville, Austin, DC, all these places that had huge vibrant music economies and a whole spectrum where people could develop their entire image, those artists are fleeing those places now. We have more performing musicians and more venues in Portland than we do in Nashville. And that's not because Portland's doing great. It's because Nashville is struggling. And honestly, what I'm hearing from the venue owners and artists that in Nashville is that Live Nation played an enormous component of that.
My last question is, what are some upcoming events and what do you want people to walk away from this conversation with, I guess, and how can they get involved if they wish to get involved?
Yeah, so two things. First of all, Music Portland always hosts a community event. It's normally first Monday, but this month, the first Monday of September is going to be Labor Day. So the first Tuesday this year, or this month, September 3rd, we're going to be having a community Q&A session and a bit of a public rally of trying to get some folks who are hearing about this, get them excited and get them involved. So we haven't yet aligned it on a location for where that's going to be. It's going to be in close proximity to where the proposed Live Nation venue will be in the Central East Side. But that's the first way that folks can get it. And they can learn more about that. It will be all the details once we finalize them, hopefully soon, will be on musicportland.org. If folks want to be kept involved in this, we have a mailing list and an opportunity for folks to get to volunteer or just to learn more about this, again, on our website. And so I would really recommend folks check out our website, musicportland.org/livenation. We have a whole timeline of what has happened dating back to 2018 with this whole situation with Live Nation and how I have specifically been involved. We have links to all the great media that we've been getting and great attention about this. And we have ways that folks can get immediately involved and activated and help truly let our voices be heard about this, because we need an all hands on deck approach.
Thank you for tuning into KBOO News. I'm your reporter, Zachary Jones-Murray. And as always, it was a privilege and a pleasure. Till next time.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Zachary Jones-Murray. The UN has expressed concern over arbitrary detentions, torture, and violations of due process in Israeli prison facilities since October 7th. But the UN and many other observers say the abuse of Palestinian prisoners has been going on much longer than that. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Zarefa Barut, a PhD candidate at the University of Exeter's European Center for Palestinian Studies, about the plight of Palestinians who end up in Israeli prisons.
Torture of Palestinian prisoners, is this on a whole new level? I mean, we've heard in the past that the Israelis would take prisoners and put the burlap bags over their heads and shake them. That was one of their main forms of torture. And do you think they've just gone way beyond that? Or is what they're doing now kind of pretty much a repeat of what they've done in the past?
That's a good question. A lot of the tactics that they've been using are tactics that are routine and assumptions that anyone can make out of the treatment of prisoners on a daily basis in Israeli prisons, but it's been escalated to the extreme in many regards. For example, before October 7th, prisons in Israel were already overcrowded. But now we're seeing levels of overcrowding that have exceeded even that level of overcrowding that we were seeing before. The extent and intensity of torture has become unbelievably and indescribably more extreme. And this isn't just my analysis, but this is prisoners that are re-entering Israeli prison who had also been detained during some of Israel's most notorious moments in history in terms of its treatment of prisoners, like the First Intifada, saying, we've experienced prison during these moments in history, and this is unlike anything that we've ever experienced. So those are prisoners and former detainees themselves saying these things. Reports are coming out frequently. There was a UN report that just came out in July that described a great deal of this torture and abuse, and another one that just came out the other day from Beit Salem, which is entitled Welcome to Hell, describing the abuse and the torture, which they conclude is systemic and approved from the highest levels of the Israeli government, which is happening consistently and methodically across Israeli detention camps and prisons.
Do you think the higher, more intense level of torture has to do with the extreme nature of the government or the October 7th attacks? What do you think is behind it? The idea of crushing the Palestinian spirit, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the role that torture has always taken. It was a repression measure to thwart and subdue Palestinian resistance. But I think that they saw on October 7th and afterwards, even globally, the impact of Palestinian resistance in all of its forms and how they've truly failed in subduing the Palestinian people in Gaza and beyond.
It sounds like it's almost desperation on their part.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also within Israel itself, you have a people that are so infuriated and confused about, you know, the motives of everything that happened. And their anger also gives Israel the green light to really do whatever it wants. I mean, we saw a couple weeks ago, a Palestinian prisoner had been sexually abused so horribly that he had been hospitalized. And you had supporters of these soldiers that did this abuse rushing to the prison or rushing to the interrogation centers to defend those soldiers. So that's also the mentality that many Israeli civilians have, where they've really allowed Israel to have an open season on Palestinian prisoners in terms of abuse and torture.
And some of these prisoners, are they being released by the Israelis?
Or some of them, yes. I mean, there have been these really miraculous stories. As someone who has family in Gaza, who has missing family in Gaza, I really can't imagine what a lot of these people are experiencing. But there have been people that have had relatives missing since the beginning of the war that are being released after they had assumed that they had been dead for 9-10 months, being released, and it turned out that they were in Israeli detention camps the entire time. So yeah, there are definitely people being released, and that's where we're getting these stories, because Israel, I mean, right after October 7th, implemented a policy, according to this Beit Salem report, which was kind of a complete lockdown on Palestinian prisoners and their access to the outside world, including legal counsel, but also the press. So a lot of the information that we're getting right now is coming from those people that happen to be released. But each person that's released, our image and the illustration of the horrors of Israeli detention are just escalating each time.
Do you know what percentage of the prisoners are women and children?
I'm not sure about that. And a lot of this information, again, I don't think that we're going to receive for a long time. We don't even have an accurate idea of how many Palestinians are in detention at this moment. Some people are estimating 10,000, but then there's also 10,000 plus people in Gaza that are still missing. So there are so many people where we don't know their whereabouts. We don't know their conditions. And there's all these Israeli detention camps like Sede Tamon outside of Gaza. We're unfamiliar with how many prisoners are there, let alone what their conditions are like.
Do you know if there's U.S. complicity in that aspect of what the Israelis are doing? I mean, obviously, we know the U.S. is sending arms and giving diplomatic and political support. But how about in the case of the prisoners being tortured? Or maybe the U.S. feels like, well, the Israelis can handle that themselves.
Yeah, I mean, as I think it was Kamala Harris the other day just said, we're not going to tell Israel how to conduct this war, repeating this line that we've heard so frequently. So absolutely, there is U.S. complicity at the deepest levels, especially when you see some of the most high-ranking political officials in Gaza defending the rape of Palestinian prisoners openly and proudly and saying this is what prisoners deserve. So when these are the people that you've had these historic diplomatic ties with, and this doesn't compel you to reconsider or to sever these ties, there is absolutely complicity at every level in the U.S. government.
Have you seen anything like this in the modern world take place? I mean, we know that there's horrible situations in Yemen and Sudan and Congo. Do you think this is even worse than any of those, or is it too hard to say?
I don't know if I can make that comparison as of now. Again, because even though these reports are coming out from the UN, from Beit Salem, there's still so much, I'm sure, that is going to be uncovered. I think what does set Israel apart in this regard is that it's standing globally, its relationship with the United States, with a superpower, and how the United States has set no red lines for Israel. If another country is to do this, there would be sanctions, there would be accountability in some form. But what we've seen is that for Israel, within Israel itself, and within the United States, its largest supporter, there aren't any red lines.
Yeah, I recall in the 60s, the U.S.-backed right-wing coup in Indonesia, they slaughtered anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million people. But that was kind of hidden. You know, you didn't see that on social media. They didn't have social media.
Right. But,
it seems like a lot of U.S. policy, a lot of U.S. activity has not been out there like this is.
Yeah, that's absolutely a valid point. And I think that adds an entirely new dimension also to American complicity, that the American people are able to see in real time the faces and the demeanor and the physical torture on the bodies of these prisoners when they're released. And there's irrefutable evidence of what's happening in these facilities. And yet it's not changing U.S. policy towards Israel. So I think that adds a completely new dimension to our understanding of U.S. complicity.
Do you see a big contrast, as many people have, between the U.S. attitude toward Ukraine, the Ukraine-Russia war, and the Israeli assault on Palestine?
Just in regards to double standards?
Yeah. I mean, if you believe that the Ukrainians, as they say, have the right to defend themselves, why wouldn't you believe that the Palestinians do? You know, I guess it's seen differently. It's like, because the Palestinians are seen as terrorists.
Yeah, absolutely. The same resistance that they partake in, that the Ukrainians are partaking in against the Russians, rather than being seen as heroic or any of these things, it warrants genocide. It warrants torture in its most horrific forms. It warrants things that the free democratic world, the free Western world, like the use of rape and sexual abuse and starvation and things of this nature, that we claim to be champions against these things. We find that the dehumanization of the Palestinian people and people aligned with the Palestinian people on lines of race or religion, that there are no red lines for these people, despite what, Western values may be in regards to white Christian people. There's free rein when it comes to these same actions, the same resistance, when it's coming from the wrong person or a person with a differing agenda from America's imperialist colonial agenda.
Any light at the end of the tunnel, as they say?
I think as a Palestinian and as someone that's been studying this subject for a very long time, absolutely. I think the light at the end of the tunnel, though, is not going to come from a Kamala presidency or a Trump presidency or anything that the U.S. does for that matter, but it's going to come from the steadfast resolve of the people of Palestine. They have undergone horrific torture in the past. They have undergone ethnic cleansing in the past. And look at us now. We have a global movement for freedom and a global movement against occupation, despite everything that Palestinians have gone through. If you even see the resolve of Palestinian children that before this war, before this genocide, 9 out of 10 children in Gaza had PTSD and suffered from PTSD before this war. But you see their samud, their steadfastness, despite everything that they've already been through in their lives. So absolutely, I think that the light at the end of the tunnel is the strengths and the historic strengths of the people of Palestine and the people of Gaza in particular.
That's University of Exeter's PhD candidate Zarefa Barut speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Zachary Jones-Naray, and see you next time. And it's been a privilege and a pleasure.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Independence. Not being subject to another's authority or jurisdiction. Grassroots.